does have an NBA team in the playoffs. Okay. Before we have our invocation, and I know I'm going to miss some people, and when I do, perhaps we can get a couple of the names that I do miss. But I want to take a moment to have a brief moment of silence for a number of people that we have lost in CCB and ACB over the last year. These people include Greg Scott of the Bay Area, Jerry Fields, longtime CCB member who made so many sandwiches and did so many things for this organization that it's impossible to count them. Various people within ACB as well, including Gail Krause, the wife of Paul Edwards, who has been at many California conventions, and a person who has ever attended an ACB convention. She finished our registration packets together and it made everything work just so well. All of these people, and I know I'm missing some more, and I apologize for that. Sharon Kieran as well, of course. And many other people that we could possibly name. So let's have a moment of silence for all of our ACB and CCB family members that we have lost. Thank you. Okay, to do our invocation today, we have Reverend Dexter McNamara, the Executive Director of the Interfaith Service Bureau, Sacramento. Mr. McNamara.
After the wonderful things that you do. I'm the director of the Interfaith Service Bureau here in Sacramento. I'm a Presbyterian minister. As a director of the Interfaith Service Bureau, what our organization is to do is different faith backgrounds together to begin to listen to each other in new ways and to work together in new ways. And I was thinking about how that would connect with what you do as you gather here and the issues that you deal with. And I thought one of the things that I try to do, and our organization tries to do, is obviously get people to perceive things in new ways. As you know, so many times religions can be extremely, you know, significant and valuable for the people who are in them. And it's also easy for those individual religions to get locked into assuming that this is the only way to perceive things. So as Christians and Jews and Muslims and Sikhs and Baha'is and Buddhists and Hindus begin to learn about each other, we begin to say, gee, we need to perceive the world in new ways. And it seems to me that's one of the challenges that you face, obviously just in terms of yourselves, but even more so in terms of helping society continually be challenged about how we perceive people and how we are going to make get along together and what are the needs that do not fit everyone. And that's a challenge, isn't it, to sort of say you're here to really, one of those roles is to help society see that you don't put on just one set of glasses and assume that that works for everyone, because that just isn't the case. So I really thank you for this chance to be with you, and I really send to you my blessings and my hopes for the work that you do, and I hope you enjoy Sacramento. I want to read to you, and I think this fits right in, a prayer that I just someone sent to me over the email just a couple of weeks ago that I think speaks a whole lot about who we are and the challenges before us in whatever capacity we are. So join me in listening to this St. Teresa's prayer. May there today be peace within. May you trust God that you are exactly where you are meant to be. May you not forget the infinite possibilities that are born of faith. May you use those gifts that you have received and pass on the love that has been given to you. May you be content knowing that you are a child of God. Let this presence settle in your bones and allow your soul the freedom to sing, dance, praise, and love. It is there for each and every one of you. Amen. My blessings to you in this convention.
thank you very much, Mr. McNamara, for coming. It's great to start with thoughtful and incisive words such as those, and we greatly appreciate that. Okay. I'm going to ask for a substitute here. We're going to ask Artis Bazin, our secretary, to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay, would you please rise and put your hand over your heart? Okay, let's begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with love and justice for all. Thank you.
Okay, there's already a suggestion for a door prize out there, so maybe we can prevail on Mr. Branch. Let's hear a cheer for our staff and prevail on Mr. Branch to do one. A wheel bag from the Capital Chapter. And... since she's the closest, let's have Artis draw the door prize. She's looking for her own name, I think. Donna McCree? Are you there? Raise your hand. Okay. Frank Welty, could you make your way to a mic? Our credentials chair has some announcements before we go any further. Okay, you're not on, but maybe you are now.
Okay, there. Now I'm on, and I'm going to see how ambidextrous I am because I'm going to have to read with one hand. And one quick thing is that there are a few chapters that I need to have check in with me real quick. Make sure I have some information from this morning's meeting that I took directly. And they are ACB Capital Chapter, Outlined Inland Valley Chapter, LME Multicultural Concern, CLV, Bay Area Council, School for the Blind, and Compton. Now, most of you already have your information into me, but there are a couple items I wanted just to verify because I may have written it down wrong. Also, Solano. And then just a few other people that I need to hear from. Let me reach over to that piece of paper here. Okay, I just need to hear from Al Beagler, Jane Carlano, and being in this place throughout the afternoon. I am the front. I am in the very row on the right. So that's where I'm going to be. If we have any break after the meeting, so if I can hear from those folks, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Frank. Do we have, I think it's, was it Kathy or Mitch once told me about a person that they introduced that wasn't there. So I don't want to repeat that. But I am going to ask if Mayor Heather Fargo is in the room. Okay, well, if she comes, then I'll introduce her. But since she isn't here now, I'm going to abstain from introducing her. And an abstention, yes. And point off to accommodate his schedule and as well as to move the agenda along, I am going to Boyle to come to him. Is the State Director of Social Service, Department of Social Sector by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in November 2004. His career began in the field 30 years ago. His early inclusion of welfare reform measures proposed by Governor Ronald Reagan. much of his 20-year career as a civil servant involved welfare to work and children's issues. Mr. Boyle served as the Director County of Riverside Department of Public Social Services for the past 9 years. Okay. I'm going to prevail upon Mr. Boyle because the mayor has arrived, and so I am going to take back that introduction and go over it later. So whatever you thought you heard about Mr. Boyle, forget it, and you, so that you can hear it again. Okay, I am very honored to have, as a resident of the city of Sacramento, especially, I am honored to have with us today, to welcome us to my city and hers, Mayor Heather Fargo. The mayor was born in Oakland and grew up in the Central Valley. She earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Environmental Planning and Management from the University of California, Davis. She was first elected to the city in 1989, where she served 3 terms. Is now her second term as mayor. She on so many boards that although some of them, it would probably be several minutes. And do a favor.
Thank you.
To say, suffice it to say, that we have an outstanding mayor who has been involved in and aware of our activities. And again, we are pleased to have with us today Mayor Heather Fargo.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for such a warm welcome. It's really my honor to be here today and welcome you to your gathering. We're very proud here in the city of Sacramento of having such a diverse community and trying to have an inclusive community, and that means people with disabilities and people who just happen to be blind as well. So we are really happy that you have chosen Sacramento as a place to have your meeting. I hope that the Holiday Inn takes good care of you, and I hope that you have a wonderful time while you're here in Sacramento. This is, in fact, Earth Day, and I just got back from another event over there, so happy Earth Day to everybody. And thank you for everything that you do to make Sacramento and California and the world a better place to live in. It is really my honor to represent all of you and to be here today to give you your official welcome to your gathering. I don't know, are you going to be here all weekend long?
All weekend.
All weekend, wonderful. Well, we have some great weather outlined for you today, this weekend. So hopefully you won't have to be in meetings and be able to explore a little bit as well. Very hard on making our city more accessible. We're going to continue to do that, and you definitely are welcome in our city, and thank you for today. So enjoy your gathering.
Thank you very much to Mayor Fargo for making the time in what is a busy schedule.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Now, nobody remembers this, but we're going to have a gentleman by the name of Dennis Boyle address us.
Well, maybe we will. I might just get up and leave now.
And I'm not going to reintroduce Mr. Boyle because of it. But I just want to say that it is, to my knowledge, we have never had the head of that particular department at one of our conventions, or not at least in its current title of that department. So it's been many, many years. And that department has so many issues of which blind and visually impaired people have great concerns. And so we are very pleased today to have with us Dennis Boyle.
Well, thank you very much for that that warm welcome, the second one equal to the first. I have to tell you how pleased I am and how proud I am to have been invited here today. I've been in my post now for a few months, and this is the first organization outside of a government organization that has asked me to come and visit with them. And I was very, very pleased to accept your invitation. I think what I'd like to do, if I may, is just spend a couple of minutes telling you about me and how I came to be where I am, because a lot of the events in my life, just as the events in your life, have shaped who you are today, me too. And I think to understand where we're going to go with the department, it sometimes helps to know what happened in the life we're going to be leading it. So as we go through, if you have questions, please ask. At the end, I'll pause, and you can ask questions about me, my life, my plans for the department, whatever interests you. I didn't grow up, or at least I wasn't born here in California. I was born back in Pennsylvania. My family, we got at least one Pennsylvanianite. My family comes west part of Pennsylvania. I was born actually in Pittsburgh. I have a lot of family still in that area. Lived in Harrisburg for a little bit. My father, his family out here to the west coast, actually to Southern California in the 1850s. He was part of that great migration where just a ton of people left the cold east and came out to the warm weather that they found in Southern California. I came out there when I was about 10 or so, and it was really a difficult move for me. I was 10 years old in Harrisburg. I was going to the school that I wanted to go to. I had friends that I valued. I had a girlfriend that I really liked. And I saw absolutely no reason for me to leave. My parents, however, had other ideas, and they insisted that we pull up stakes and come out here. I did strike a bargain with them. I loved animals then and now, and had always wanted to have a dog. So my bargain for coming out to the West Coast with them was that I would be permitted to have my first dog. We moved out here. I'll never forget that trip. We came out in a four-engine airliner, one of the old Supersonic Constellation airplanes. You remember the ones with the big three tails and just a big, beautiful airplane that flew really slow, as I recall. Came out here, settled in. I got my dog. His name was Saber. Saber was a wonderful dog for me. He lasted about, 3 months. Well, you see, the problem was that as much as I liked the dog had some bad habits. My mother had some favorite china that she moved out here. It was in the garage and stacked neatly in boxes, and Saber didn't know his own strength. And a good part of the china was no more. Well, you know, actually, that wasn't really what did it. That did not do Saber well. What really happened was the morning that my mother woke up, rolled out of bed, and stood on top of a gift that Saber had left for her there the night before. That was it. That was it for the dog.
I agree. I really like your mom.
But after that, you know, since I was already out here anyway, I decided to stay with the family and not go back to Pennsylvania. I went through schools in Redlands, California, went through the rest of grammar school and through a high school. Who is here from Southern California? Anybody here from San Bernardino? San Bernardino? Are you guys familiar with Aquinas High School? Anybody familiar with Aquinas High School? Pardon me? I think so.
I think I know where that is. I remember
Riverside. This is out, as I recall, it was out near St. Bernardine's Hospital in Meridino.
Yeah.
At the end of my it was decided by others that I shouldn't attend there, and I got kicked out of school. Now, it's important that you know that about my background. But the only important thing to know about that incident, that I want you to know about that incident, and this is very, very important, it was not my fault.
No.
I wound up graduating from Redlands High School. During that time, my interest in animals expanded from the dog to livestock, to farming, and to ranching. And about that time, I decided that my lifelong ambition was going to be a rancher. Throughout high school, and I attended junior college in San Bernardino at San Bernardino Valley College, and through graduate.
Yep.
And then I went on to Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and my interest in raising animals grew. I had two very close friends. They were brothers, and we went through a lot of adventures together during high school and the early college years, and we worked together. And we worked out in the fields together, and I remember doing hard work, hard physical work, picking up bales of hay out of the field. And these two brothers were much stronger than I was. They were much bigger than I was, probably not better looking than I was. But I struggled lifting two wire bales of hay out of the field, and they had no difficulty with three wire bales. So they always put me to shame when it came to work. We raised sheep together. And going to Cal Poly, we worked part-time on a ranch together. 1968, and I graduated from Cal Poly, going into the world with this love of animals and this love of farming, went into the business. But there was something at that time that took me off of my direct course in animals. And no, it wasn't a her. It was Vietnam. Yes, it was Vietnam. And I was given the opportunity to serve my, which really was early military. And one of the things I remember from growing, my dad took us kids, two brothers, and took us on several field at Gettysburg. Have any of you been there?
Yes.
It was for me a very awe-inspiring place. And I remember walking around that hallowed ground of Devil's Den. And I remember standing on the both sides of the field where General Pickett led his charge, if you remember that. He led his men through an open field, I think it was a wheat field, an open field for about a mile right into the teeth of the Union guns. And it was a very, very awful battle for them to be in. And that marked the high water point, as it's called, for the Confederacy. In any event, I had a great deal of admiration for military men who fought for their country. And in 1968, I had that opportunity. I enlisted in the United States Navy and was accepted into the Naval Aviation Program. For 4 years, I was a navigator in the backseat of a two-person jet, doing reconnaissance, flying off the back of a carrier. I had the opportunity to serve in Vietnam. I had 87 combat missions, 85 of which were unarmed in this reconnaissance jet and two in the F-4 Phantom. It was very life-changing for me, life-enforcing. It really grew me up, and it taught me a lot about what was important in life and taught me something about honor as well. So when I came back from Vietnam in 1972, I no longer wanted to make my life's work being a rancher, and I really wanted to give something back to society. So I looked around for opportunities, and in 1973, I had the opportunity to come to work right here in Sacramento for the administration of then-Governor Reagan in the Welfare Department, and what I had the opportunity to work on was, of all things, welfare reform. I stayed here in Sacramento for almost 20 years, working on a variety of jobs in the administrations that followed Governor Reagan, but always coming back to the welfare to work programs. I was privileged to be here in 1985 when the legislature introduced and passed a very, very important piece of social legislation called the GAIN program. Do any of you remember the GAIN program? Do you? That taught me a couple of things, the passage of that legislation. There had been a lot of turmoil in the legislature for 10 years over welfare to work programs. And there came a guy in 1985, and I'm drawing a blank on his name now. He was he became later the mayor of San Francisco. He was an assemblyman. No, it was Art Agnos. Art Agnos was one hell of a guy. He knew people, he cared about people, and he knew the art of compromise. And in 1985, he led the legislature to the passage of this bill. He was working the floor and getting people to agree to things that in the past they might have hated. And it came to be the end of the session, and it was the very last day of the session in August before this GAIN legislation was even introduced to the legislature. It was introduced one day, and in the course of 24 hours, it passed through two committees in the Assembly, was passed by the Assembly, sent over to the Senate, went through three committees in the Senate, was changed slightly, had to go back to the Assembly, was passed, was concurred upon and passed, and delivered to the governor's desk at 4 a.m. the next morning. That's lightning fast for a bill. And what a remarkable change that legislation has had for the lives of so many people in California and in the nation, because what we demonstrated here in California was that just because people aren't like the rest of us, just because people maybe have some things going against them, doesn't mean that they should be marginalized. And what we learned was just because people were poor didn't mean that they didn't have some smarts, and that they didn't have some ability to support themselves and some ability to make a life for themselves. That was an important learning, and it applies to a lot of other things in life. Have you ever known anyone who was marginalized just because they looked a certain way or were a certain way? Yeah, I can imagine. So that was an important learning for us. And people who otherwise we didn't think had a chance in life went to work, and they went to work in droves and proved everyone wrong. And that led in a straight line to the historic legislation in 1996 signed by President Clinton, which reformed in a major, major way the welfare system that we had had since the 1930s. So I was privileged to be the state bureaucrat responsible for leading the implementation of that bill. And then in 1992, I had the opportunity to leave Sacramento and go to the local level. One of the things about working at the state level is that you are very, very much removed from the from people who benefit from the workings of government. The only program that I had ever worked with that directly benefited people actually is one that you're probably familiar with, and it was the program which provided food for guide dogs. And I was responsible for running that program back in the middle to late 1980s. In any event, that was my only experience in actually running a program. When I left the state administration in 1992, I went to work in Riverside, California. I had the opportunity to return home to Southern California. And that was a really fun thing for me. During the 12 years that I was there, the last 9 years as the director, I got to work on many very important programs that saved lives and made lives better. I learned a lot about mission and the mission of organizations then. And the mission of the county welfare department was described to me in a way that was very bureaucratic. It was to process paper, to pay checks, to do a number of things that were very process-oriented. But what I learned was that the mission of the Riverside County Department of Public Social Services and the mission of the State Department of Social Services and the mission of every other county social services department in the state is truly to help build strong families, to make individuals stronger and to make their families stronger. And when you do that, if you think about it, the mission of making families stronger helps make our communities stronger. And when you have stronger communities, you have a stronger California. And in the final result, what we're doing is building a stronger America. And so that's what our mission is to one step at a time, one life at a time, help to make America stronger. I was there very happily until last year. And shortly after Governor Schwarzenegger was elected to his current post, I got a call from the transition team asking me to come up here to Sacramento. And what they wanted me to do was to leave a life that I loved, a team and partners that I had worked long and hard to develop a relationship with, a life that was very, very rewarding. While I was there, I had the opportunity to lead almost 140,000 individuals from poverty into employment. 140,000 people over a nine-year period of time who 15 years ago, would have been written off. And at first, when they asked me to come up here, I declined the opportunity. I was having fun and wasn't sure that I wanted to leave home. I had family down in that area. The Schwarzenegger administration was persuasive, though, and I agreed to come up here. I came up last December and have been working hard at getting to know these programs and these people and my sister departments and the public that I now serve. I love Southern California and didn't want to leave. So I haven't. My home is still in Redlands, California, and I commute during the week. On Monday morning, my wife, if you're familiar with Southern California, my wife works at Kaiser Hospital in Fontana. And so early Monday morning, in fact, at 0:30 Monday morning, she leaves a little bit early for work, and she drops me off at the airport in Ontario, and I fly up here to begin the work week. I am very, very fortunate in one aspect of this this change for me and this opportunity here with the governor, and that is that my parents are both alive. And they live here in Sacramento. They are my mom is 88. My dad is 89, going to be 90 this year. In fact, my mom will be 89 this year. They are living independently, but you can imagine that they're quite getting quite on in years, and they are a little more feeble than what they were in the past. But I have been given a tremendous gift in that they invited me to come and live with them. For the time up here that I'm here during the week. And I tell you, I have had the most wonderful experiences being able to relate to them and have conversations with them that you just don't get to have when you call somebody over the telephone or you visit them at Christmas. In fact, I'll share a quick story, if I may. One of the things that my mom has done is frequently bring out memory things, like old records and old pictures that she wants me to look at. And 2 weeks ago, she brought out these old 78 RPM records that she wanted me to listen to. And along with them, as she pulled them out of the box, came this picture of her when she was in high school. And it was a picture of her entire class, just one person at a time, and with their teacher and their principal. She was 15 years old, a junior in this high school. And she's telling me all these stories about each person who's pictured on the page. And my mom was telling me a little gossip about each person. She was really getting into it. She's sharing a lot of personal stories about the kids and what they were like and who they dated and what they were capable of. And she came up to her own picture. And you can picture me sitting there. I'm 58 years old, and I'm with my mother, and I'm very much her son at this moment. I'm really into visiting with her. And she points to her picture, and I'm looking at this very sweet, very pretty 15-year-old girl. And she slipped into telling me about, you know, it's just as if a thought had just come into her head, and it came out her mouth. And she's telling me about junior-senior prom, and she told me about her date. She's 15 years old. Her date was 22 years old. Mom! I went instantly from being a son with his mother to being the father of four daughters. My mom got very defensive, and the conversation ended. In coming here to Sacramento, I am very privileged to be working for this governor. I never would have worked for any governor prior to him. One of the things that struck me about this man is that, and in my conversation with him about coming to work here, is that he is truly interested in doing the right thing, his perception of the right thing, and he isn't fazed by people who take a partisan line with him. He doesn't care if it's the right Republican thing or the right Democratic thing. If it is the right thing to do, that's what he allows me to do. And I was breaking with that. My goals, the things that I want to do here during the time, there are dozens of things that need done well, and I intend to work at each and every one of them. But there are three things that come to mind that I want to accomplish. The first thing, of course, is that I want to make a contribution to helping people out of poverty. And the best way I know of doing that is through employment. There's nothing like self-sufficiency through employment. And I want to refocus the state's welfare directors on the idea that people are capable of going to work no matter what your first impressions. We need to believe in people. And once we believe in people, that belief transfers from us to people sometimes no longer believe in and can take care of themselves. So that's our first goal, is to make a difference those who are judged capable because of where they have come from. The second thing I want to do is for state. I'm responsible for running the Child Protective Services program in Riverside County into Child Protective Services program at a time where we had had tragedy after tragedy after tragedy in families. And I want to tell you, we were constantly improving that program, and I learned early on that you need partners in order to do that. No matter what your lot in life, no matter what you're trying to do, if you try to do it by yourself, you're not going to succeed. So what I did was partner with the district attorney, I partnered with the sheriff, I partnered with the nonprofits, I partnered with the courts, I partnered with former foster children, I partnered with whomever I could to bring into the system and open the system up and raise the veil of confidentiality, and together as partners improve the system, and we did. And I would like to do that here. Children are important, and I saw too many children damaged horribly and killed by caretakers who should not have done that. So I want to make a difference for kids while I'm here at the state level. And the third thing that I want to do, kind of along the same lines, my part of government, I want to open up what we do so that partners and that people who want to know what we have an opportunity to too often they should or the draft regular are impacted. And that's one that I want to teach to my department as I leave. So I realize that there are tons and tons and tons of things that I will do and that I want to do well, but those are the three things that I want every person in my department to know is important to me so that they will help me accomplish those things. Well, that's who I am, where I came from, and what's important to me. And I am looking forward to knowing you guys for a long time. A thing that my department can do, partners with you, or if you ever have difficulty with any of the people that we deal with, I hope that you'll feel free to contact us. And I look forward to doing that. I'm going to pause in just a minute and see if there are any questions. But in the meantime, I see a question. Yes. Sure.
Can people get to a mic so that we can have you on the air since we are recording your voices?
Okay. Can I take it off because it's so tall for me? All right. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to have this opportunity to speak to you, Mr. Boyle. I'm Hild, and I am employed at Authority for IHSS County. I'm a key person, and in the capacity of representing people with disabilities in our community. And as you know, in Los Angeles County, we have somewhere around 450,000 IHSS consumers. Many ask county and the state. I do training for us consumers. My main concern today is the CEO serving on the California Health Incentives Improvement Project. I'm chairing that committee, the 250% working disabled grant, and we're working in partnerships with EDD, and we have a steering committee which the members of DSS are participating, as well as most of the other agencies in the state that have anything to do with work and disability. So I've been doing organizing an L.A. County steering committee to do trainings for frontline staff professionals in L.A. County to get the word out about 250% program working disabled, that people can work, keep Medi-Cal, keep IHSS, and earn 250% of poverty level. This morning I did a presentation for the Association of Multicultural Concerns, and there are a lot of people in this are interested and concerned. My question is, in doing the trainings in L.A. County, I've run into somewhat of a roadblock, the Department of Biz. They do represent, but they don't staff by the executive director of IHSS. that they will train their own people. The problem is, what are these things? And I really would appreciate your input and your assistance in getting this information out to the people who need it.
Sure thing, Teddy. Which department head are you dealing with down there?
Dr. Henry Felder.
Actually, Henry is not the department head.
No, Bryce Yokomiso.
Bryce, yes.
But Henry Felder is in charge of IHSS.
And I would be, you know, it sounds like the kind of thing that I would be
you're
very.
Here.
Yes,
I'm right
I am.
In front of me. Okay. I don't know where that voice is coming from.
I would be very pleased to contact Bryce on your behalf. And I see that you have a card.
I do.
And I've got a card for
Thank
you.
Thank you very much.
I'll follow up with a telephone call to you next week, and we'll see if I can be of any help to you.
Thank
okay?
You.
Nice to meet you. Yes, sir. Standing with your hand up.
You can gain a little extra weight this time there, Ed. Hi, Dennis. It's an honor to talk to you today. I've heard And my name is Dan. I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the California. My question is, you ran the guide dog, the only social services program for blind people. There's an Office of Services to the Deaf, and there's an Office of Services to the Blind. And I would plead with you, as a representative of the administration, the governor has a plan to cut the cost of living for SSI recipients. Now, this will have a direct impact on social services because blind people will find it very difficult to pay their rent. We are finding now that there is an increasing homeless population of blind people. CCB has had to rescue several homeless people that... One gal was 23 years old and was almost on the street in Woodland and almost had to sleep out on the street on day 9. Social services was not prepared to handle her. They said, she have all these rehabs. You have all these programs. You get all the services. You already have enough services. Well, it's not. So we urge that you cost of living adjustment for all because, you know, rents in the Bay Area, Southern California, Sacramento Valley are going sky high. 70% of us don't work. And so the other issue, too, on the Office of Services to the Blind, is there any way we can create a dialogue with the Department of Social Services to get social services for us as blind people? Because rehab doesn't serve a lot of blind people. They don't provide social services. They're an employment arm. So can we start a dialogue to... You know, there's 1.5 staff members right now in the Offices of Services to the Blind serving the entire state of California. So, and we're not, well, they do the guide dog program and that's about it. And social services is so much more encompassing. There's crimes against people who are blind and visually impaired. People are left out on the street. So if we could start a dialogue with the CCB and your office, that would be great.
You know, there are a number of programs in that I think need to be involved in that dialogue. And the office to talk with this and for example, and whatever other grant department you guys be helpful to us on. And I'm hopeful that as we move into this, the latter part of this budget season, that increased revenues to the department over what we thought we were going to have last fall will make the budget picture a little bit brighter for us. Thank you for asking the question. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
The mic isn't working. What did you do the mic down? There we go. My name is Catherine Skivers. I'm immediate past president of this organization, and I've had the pleasure of working with Tom Lee quite a bit. And I have been around a very long time. I went to the first meeting of this organization in 1949, so I've had the chance to observe people coming and going in your department. At one time, we had welfare... offices in all the major cities, and many blind people, Perry Sundquist, Linda Bartis, and others worked in those offices. Now, am I correct that I believe I have heard that you now in the Social Service Department for the Blind, our division or section, just has a guide dog program and something for seniors. And I'm wondering, what can this organization do, and how can you help us, and how can we help you get some more money into this department? I believe, am I correct, that the deaf have a program that has over five, doesn't have anything like that? We need some equity there. How can we help it, and how do you recommend we go about it?
Well, I guess this. First of all, I really appreciate having taken that as an important step in inviting to here. I hope that when you have future gatherings, you would see fit to invite me back so that we can have a continuing dialogue at my level. And what I would suggest you do is collaborate with Tom, and don't limit yourself to just dealing with us. I think that you have to become active in dealing with your local legislators, state legislators, you know, back in your districts where you live, and reach out to as many of them as you can until you find someone who's going to be willing to take these issues as their own. And then as an association, you can work with them. But that's what I would recommend that you do.
We hope that this won't be your last visit to us, and we would like to not only visit with Tom, we'd like to come and talk to you. We spoke with some other people in your department. We're welcome services. And we hope that you will. We have, you may not remember, but we have with Reed. It would be great to meet with your people, too. It would be mutual. We do have a legislative program chair, and I can bring this chair and any other chair and come. You can have us.
Okay. Great. I would please, too.
For one more question, we have it. Okay, I want to express, we do have one more. Okay, sorry about that.
Okay, my name is Jane Cardis, and I'm from Mendocino County, and I'm also on the IHHS Board of Directors. We've been making frequent visits to Sacramento, and we're coming again in June, and we're very concerned about the proposed cuts, and in particular about the salaries of the in-home supportive services employees. We do feel that it's extremely important for people to stay in their own homes. It will save the state a tremendous amount of money. And I just would like to put my two bits in there from Mendocino County and ask you to please conserve what we have right now for people being able to stay in their home, for the older American, for the blind and other disabled people. Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to say that I think that the IHSS program is a very, very important service, and it is one that keeps people out of community care, and to the extent to keep people on their own home, that's what we want to do.
Thank you.
I want to conclude by thanking Mr. Boyle very, very much for speaking to us today. It really is an honor. It is a way to build a relationship that we need, and we will certainly intend to take you and your department up on maintaining that relationship and enhancing it in the future. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. And thank you again for the invitation.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm told to draw a door prize, and we will draw a door prize. In fact, Ms. Dennis, before you go, could you have time to draw a door prize?
Get the right one now, Dennis Deck. This is a BSC game donated by BSC Games, Greater San Joaquin Valley.
Greater San Joaquin Valley is donating a computer game. Ellie Wong, who is in the room, I don't think.
Okay.
He's not here. Gabe. Boy.
Diane B. Phelps.
Diane Phelps. Napa is heard from.
Is she here?
Raise your hand.
You have to raise your hand.
Raise your hand and yell.
Oh, she's back here. She's recovering.
Okay. We have... We're going to draw two more little things very quickly, or try to. We have a donation from Mr. Welty, who asked us to draw as a door prize his President's Dinner and Banquet ticket. since he is unable to use them.
All right.
And if Frank tells me to do something, I do it.
All right.
No, we're going to do them separately.
Okay,
you don't get them both. We'll do President's Dinner first. We've got to get that
Sally?
Done. Onetta Sally, are you here? Do you already have a ticket? Oh, dear. Well?
Betty Henderson?
Betty's here. Betty's there. Okay, let's draw the banquet ticket and we'll hand them both out at the same time.
All right. Julie Delzer.
Joni Delzer, it is.
It says Julie.
Joni.
It says
I think it's
Julie.
Is it?
Says Julie Delzer. No, it says Julie Delzer.
Is there a Julie Delzer here? I don't.
She has a ticket.
Okay. Anyone? Let's draw again. Jerry Wood?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Is Jim Henley in the room? Jim Henley. You are not. So now we're going to go. We're switching our agenda around for logistical reasons, and we're now going to go to a discussion of some federal legislation and legislative seminar. In fact, would Lucy Greco make her way to the front? She will be a part of this. Oh, well, this is one of those conventions where all sorts of things are happening. We can do some more forgetting about what I just said. Yeah, because it is. Jim Henley is here. So we are going to get him on in his time slot, which he graciously changed in order to assist us in helping with switching another agenda item. Sometimes things happen. And so this item is of great interest to me. I love history. I hope you will, too. It's a little fun and entertainment. So to present us with a little bit of history of Sacramento, we have Jim Henley, the Sacramento President of County Society. Jim?
Thank you. You have my apologies to listen to me when you could be. It's really quite nice out there. But that's your bad luck. Sorry about that. And, yes, I was the president of the County Historical Society, but I lost that job about 2 days ago, for which I'm not unhappy, actually. I did it for 3 years. That's enough. I also am the historian for the city and the county of Sacramento and have done projects here for almost 40 years.
Excuse me. Let's have a little order in the crowd, please.
For almost 40 years, going back to the starting of the old Sacramento. But this is a kind of little fun presentation, and it's a little different than what I normally do. And it is entitled Indomitable City. The city of Sacramento is governed by a charter, rather more unusual than the normal general law cities that California is more used to. In 1863, the city changed its charter and adopted a city seal entitled Erbst Indomita, which translates to Indomitable City. Why such an unusual title? We need to go back to before there was a state, to before the U.S. war with Mexico, to a time when Sutter was looking for a site for his fort. The local natives pointed to a low hill on the Plano and American rivers, and that high ground was never flooded by the frequent annual inundations of the rivers. Sutter would build his fort on that site near what is now 27th and L Streets. A series of events would follow that would earn the city its nickname, Indomitable City. On June 14th, 1846, an unruly band of insurrectionists, some would say horse thieves, seized General Mariano Vallejo at his Sonoma adobe after first having stolen some horses in what is now Lower Sacramento County. After a large consumption of the general's liquor, their leader, William Ide, said to the group, "Choose this what you will be. We will be robbers or we must be conquerors." The historian James Holliday suggested lack of sobriety. They felt the latter sounded. Hence, it be suggested that modern California was born at that moment, an infant swaddled in blankets of chaos. The next three decades would be marked by confusion and a frequent lack of order or process. At the start of this infancy, there was no effective legal system. There were no rules of law for thieves. The many land grants issued by the Mexican government were in disarray. Most people do not appreciate how discordant the events of the 30 years after the Bear Flag Revolt were for the emerging state. In less than a decade, California would move from an ox cart economy with wheels made from rounds cut out of tree trunks to a large, rich, complex economic system based on gold and a very large, focused, let's get rich group of immigrants, 250,000 strong. According to Sacramento Gold Rush physician and author John F. Morse, the fabric of society was little less than chaos. Everything had an anomalous appearance, system or consistency, yet there was no absolute discord or discourse. Charles E. Pickett, later known as Philosopher Pickett, was a merchant at Sutter's Fort. He shared a space with a fellow named Alderman. In an argument, Alderman advanced on Pickett with an uplifted axe. Backed up against a wall, armed with a shotgun, Pickett shot and killed the advancing Alderman. The clear case of self-defense would have ended there had there not been another merchant eager to further reduce competition at the fort. His name was Sam Brannan. Brannan tried but could not get either the first or the second alcalde for the region to arrest Pickett. Alcaldes were a remnant of Mexican rule, not yet formally replaced in California by a sheriff and American judicial system. Both alcaldes resigned in response to Brannan's insistent pestering. As a protest, that was their decision. In a meeting organized by Brannan, he appointed himself alcalde, prosecuting attorney, and judge. Fortunately for Pickett, Brannan's plans began to fall apart at that point. After assembling a jury and placing the court in session, Brannan ordered the first of many rounds of drinks for the jury, defendant, and of course the judge, prosecuting attorney, and the alderman. Captain Sutter, a member, lapsed into a comfortable sleep. When awakened during some negative testimony about aldermen, Sutter arose and is reported to have said, quote, "Gentlemen, the man's dead. He has atoned for his faults, and I will not sit here and hear his character be traduced." With some difficulty, Sutter regained his seat. After a full night of drinks and deliberation, the jury make up their minds. Brannan trial. Slightly less exciting without Brannan and the many rounds of drinks, Pickett was acquitted. On September 20, 1849, the formation of Sacramento City was proposed by a group of self-appointed founders. Their first charter was rejected by a majority of 146 voters, chiefly gamblers. A.M. Wynn, the president of the founding council, appealed to the better sort of people to organize and a vote against the lawless element. The second charter attempt passed by a majority of 296 votes. In December 1849, January 1850, winter rains filled the Central Valley, creating a lake 100 miles long and up to 50 miles wide. In Sacramento, it was called the Great Inundation, and the streets served the same purpose as the canals of Venice. Relief steamboats from San Francisco, after passing through the Carquinez Straits, set a course by straight line to Sacramento, leaving the otherwise twisted path of the Sacramento River. Following the flood, there was a squatters' riot. It broke out on the streets of Sacramento over the dispute of the legitimacy of Sutter's land grant. In October 1850, a cholera epidemic descended upon the city and killed over 1,000 people. 600 were buried in a common grave at the city cemetery. In December 1850, another flood swept over the city. Sacramento was a rough community, having experienced the first mayor shot in office in the line of duty, the first sheriff killed in office in the line of duty, the first city tax assessor killed in office in the line of duty, the first state assemblyman elected to office from jail while awaiting trial for riot, murder, and attempted murder. And this all happened in 1850. A very good year. We could talk about them, too. Sacramento County built its first courthouse in 1851, just in time to attract the state legislature, only to have 80% of the town burned to the ground in November of 1852. Following the fires in 1852 and 1853, the city was again inundated by floods. Another fire in 1854 would destroy almost half of the town and burn the Capitol courthouse to the grounds. The city saw great value for Sacramento to be the site of the permanent Capitol. To assist in that effort, the city donated one square block of city land, known today as Cesar Chavez Plaza, to the state for a grand new building. The state issued bonds and construction began, only to halt when the courts determined that the state had no authority to issue the bonds. The land was returned and the project scrapped for a few years. When land was obtained and a new building designed, the effort proved to be too much for its architect. He was declared incompetent and sent to the Stockton Insane Asylum for the rest of his life. This is better than television, believe me. In 1857, the city and the county would merge to produce a more efficient form of local government, only to get a divorce in 1863 over irreconcilable differences. And the differences were basically, guess what, about floods. The county would build higher levees, and the county interests wanted to raise the city, which they would do up to 12 feet. Severe drought descended on the Sacramento Valley in the year of 1863-64. The results were devastating for agriculture, and the great wheat crops of the state were destroyed. In the 1890s, Sacramento, like the nation, was possessed by labor unrest and a great recession. Semi-organized armies of unemployed were formed, wandered somewhat aimlessly around the Sacramento Valley, small valley communities, and the farmers. In 1894, a national railroad strike occurred. It's also known as the Great Mail Strike and also known as the Pullman Strike. It stretched across the nation from Chicago to both coasts. The most violence outside of Chicago was in Sacramento. The National Guard and later federal troops were brought to Sacramento to quell the strike and restore order. This was so severe, so violent of a potential situation, that the federal government actually brought three warships into San Francisco Harbor, three warships of the shallowest draft in their fleet, with the idea of floating one up the Sacramento River far enough to shell the city. The federal troops finally took control of the strike, or seemed to have, and a train with federal troops was derailed, killing several soldiers and civilians. The net result was a cavalry charge by the federal troops with sabers lowered up Front Street. Again, several people were killed, many were injured, but the local part of the national strike was over for Sacramento. The impact, though, was significant. A blacklist was created of strikers, and as long as 20 and 30 years later, people with the same name affiliated with the strikers were denied employment by the railroad. It also destroyed that year the agricultural crop of the valley because it was ripe and ready to go to market and no transportation was available. The National Guard was accused of mismanagement. The result was that many of its military officers were destroyed, and the largest single court in U.S. history occurred, taking power companies and them. It also resulted in the dismantling of the California National Guard and its suborganization. Yes, Sacramento survived and thrived on these adversities and earned its name Indomitable City. But what about more recent history? Let's go back too long ago, '86. With only 1 inch to spare, on the brink of the worst catastrophe of its history. If on February 19th, between late morning and late afternoon, 1 more inch of rain had fallen on Folsom Lake, the dam would have overflown. The water surge would have breached the levee at Campus Commons and perhaps River Park. Flowing out as far as Watt Avenue, it would have built up until it crossed Highway 50, probably at Power Inn Road. Unrestricted, the water would flow as far south as Meadowview and would back up into the pocket area. The city manager then, Walter Slipe, was at the city's emergency center and was contemplating probably the most momentous decision of his career. Should he call for the evacuation of 35,000 people closest to the levee, where a probable break would occur? Had the levee failed, that would have been but the first of many more devastating decisions that would have followed. But the evacuation posters were printed and many of the emergency measures in place, and the order was not given, and the rain stopped. Now, I want to close with a story that I talk to lots of groups, and this is a story that every group finds as their favorite all-time story. With the demolition of the county courthouse, and that'd be the third one on the same site, two by fire and this one by a demolition ball, it was on I Street between 6th and 7th, now the site of the jail. A large assortment of county records came to our facility in need of a new home. Our archives became that home, and other county offices began to seek us out for their records, including the county coroner. While examining the coroner's records, which are quite remarkable because they go back to 1849, my attention was drawn to one case. It obviously was a show-off piece because it had been pulled out of its box and set in a prominent location so anytime anyone went to this record room, they could grab it and show it. The little slim case was entitled Floater Number 7, John Doe. If my memory's accurate, it was dated 1853. One record in the packet contained a document that said that the coroner had been notified that a floater was discovered on the bank of the Sacramento River between what is now the I Street Bridge and what was then the mouth of the American River. The coroner recovered the body with a wheelbarrow and brought the remains to 2nd and K Streets in front of the Democratic State Journal office, a prominent early newspaper. The coroner then impaneled a jury of 6 passing local citizens to determine the cause of death. Right there on the sidewalk. The next document stated that the jury examined the body quickly and determined that floater number 7 died by drowning, by his own hand, the hand of another, or an act of God. That's a quote. Drowning by his own hand, the hand of another, or an act of God. Okay. The document noted that the coroner thanked the panel and dismissed them. A third document, which was addressed to the Sacramento County Treasurer, addressed the most important issue, a payment to the coroner of $30.50 for his services. At the bottom of that request for payment, in a small handwritten note, obviously very personal, for reasons we'll never understand really, the coroner said, "I've returned the body to the river and notified the coroner in Yolo County." The implication of returning the body to the river is indeed an intriguing factor. On April 19, 1850, an act concerning coroners was passed by the state of California, which described their duties and responsibilities in office, as well as their compensation to which they were entitled. If one examines the nature of the office of the coroner established in 1850 by that first session of the legislature, there are some interesting possibilities that might shed some light on this strange treatment of floater number 7. Paragraph 4 says, coroners may summon none less than 9 nor more than 15 persons qualified to serve as jurors. Paragraph 5 states, a person summoned who refuses to serve will be required to forfeit a sum of $1,000. Paragraph 6 says, in order to keep the business moving, when at least 6 jurors are in attendance and none other are immediately available, they can be sworn and start to conduct the business for which they were assembled. 6 people served on that jury. In the early 1850s, the average daily wage in California was $5 a day, which is actually twice the national average at that time. So such a severe penalty would have caused potential jurors to think very seriously before refusing to serve. In California and Sacramento generally, citizens viewed public duty as an obligation to be served quickly and dispensed with as soon as possible so they can return to their personal priorities. Therefore, it's possible to summon the necessary jurors in great haste from those walking by and then ask them to determine the cause of death. The nature of the official determination as to floater number 7 suggests a lack of medical and scientific evaluation. This can be easily attributed to the lack of any trained professional staff in attendance and the probable reluctance to pursue any further knowledge from any source on behalf of a John Doe. Now let's talk about the coroner's motive for a moment. The state constitution and early acts of the legislature established the coroner as a lucrative position, second only to the sheriff in terms of potential remuneration for services. The coroner was given great latitude because of a very brief description of the types of death. Indeed, you could die in your doctor's arms, and if he chose, he would inquest you because it was worth $30 to him. A coroner shall, as according to the document, quote, a coroner shall receive $30 for each inquest he may hold, and also $1 per mile for necessary travel to any inquest, to be paid by the county, not the state. It should be remembered that again, that daily wage is only $5, and the coroner's getting $30 for an inquest. Coroner's job's a part-time job. All early coroners had primary full-time jobs. In fact, this coroner was the editor of the Democratic Daily State Journal. The income potential alone would drive the coroner to inquest as many deaths as possible. They might also explain the value of returning the floater to the river and notifying his counterpart in Yolo as a professional courtesy, of course. not to mention the savings that he was giving Sacramento County by not having to perform an indigent burial. Why was the bill $30.50? But yes, $30 is easy to understand. 50 cents, though, is speculation. The round-trip distance from 2nd and K Street to the site of the body is, in fact, 1/2 mile. So it's not an easy place to live in Sacramento, and against all those tough times and fires and floods and cholera and disease and political corruption, and oh boy, I could get into a lot of things about that. Nothing's changed. Is that it? We want to say that? At any rate, I want to thank you, and I'm glad you took the time.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Henley. That was... So treat us Sacramentans a little more respect out there. You know? Okay. I'm going to bring on now to tell us a little bit about federal legislation and the legislative seminar, the ACB legislative seminar, our secretary, Artis Basin.
Hello, everybody. The legislative seminar took place the fourth weekend in February this year. And we had 8 attendants. The CCB board had voted to send 8 persons. And I'd like to mention who all came first. Richard Rieta, Stephanie Enya, Rhonda King, Lucy Greco, Lillian Scafey, Lee Morton, and Vince Calderon, and myself. We met for a day and a half first, and then on Tuesday we went to the Capitol and visited all the representatives in California. And we made a lot of appointments, and a lot of people had a great experience. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the legislation that we covered on that weekend. The issues that were covered, the first one was video description. And, of course, at that time, it hadn't been put up in the Senate yet. It was in the House, I believe, or maybe it was the other way around. Sorry. But anyway, we were asking them to promote the video description because, as you know, a few years ago, it was passed, but without any mandate and without asking the FCC to actually force the issue if people did not want to comply. And it was taken to court, and, of course, then it was not held up. So we wanted it reissued to give it more enforcement. So we were pushing for that, and that's still up, of course. I think if anybody's on the CCBL list or student list, it's been noted that it's been ask that people contact your senators and representatives that you want this. Social Security was another hot issue. Obviously, you've probably all heard about the plans of the president to have people give some of the money to private accounts instead of into Social Security. And, of course, many of us are concerned that they haven't thought about the disabled. And one of the questions that we brought to all of our representatives and senators was, how would this affect people with disability? You don't hear too much on the effects. And so we asked them to consider in any plan that they would have for the future of Social Security of what would happen to us, and also what would happen to people who paid into private accounts if they became disabled at that point. Would they be able to get Social Security disability or not? Another issue that we talked about was transportation. And, of course, the Transportation Act was suggesting a deep cut in transportation funding, and we, of course, wanted to push for that to be increased. And we also wanted to make sure that public transportation was funded heavily so that we rely on buses, that we would still have buses and trains, et cetera, versus more of it being put toward highways. We also were pushing for pedestrian safety funding to be a separate funding block versus all together, because if it's all together, obviously they use it for where they will, instead of pushing pedestrian safety. And we also were asking that they put blind persons on transportation boards so that we can have some impact when different transportation things come up in our communities. For example, if there's the rage is, of course, these new roundabouts, et cetera, that are really difficult for blind persons. And if there's other difficult street things, that we can have some import into how they be done so that it won't affect us adversely. So we asked for them to consider that. Another issue that we discussed was the reauthorization of the Rehab Act. And one of the concerns there is, at first, it looked like they were going to push for block funding of that so that the governor in each state could get a block of money and they could decide how much to put in rehab. Well, that was not put in the Rehab Act. There is also another bill, WIA Plus, which is for the employment funding, and they're still looking at trying to get that into block grants. And, of course, we are concerned that that might affect us as disabled persons. So that's something to still keep up on. The other thing we had asked in the Rehab Act is we wanted to see that the appointment of the RSA commissioner remain an appointment versus a staff position. Another issue we discussed was the Randolph Shepherd program. At that time, there was no bill in the Congress affecting Randolph Shepherd, but we had heard rumors that there was going to be something put in. Now we have been told that they're working on putting something in the Department of Defense bill that would relate to limiting the priority or getting rid of the priority in Department of Defense locations. But currently they're working on in committee to try to get something done that negotiate us the Randolph Shepherd program and NISH to work together to maybe have the blind persons do the management and hire the NISH employees for people. So they're still working on that issue, but if it does come up, of course, we would ask for people to put input to their senators and representatives. One thing we did find out that when we talk to people, a lot of congressmen are not aware of that program. They really don't know about it. So anytime you talk to your legislators, you should make them aware of that program. Most of the other issues we discussed, the congressmen and senators were very much aware of what they were, but that was one that a lot of them didn't. I want to have Lucy Greco come forward. We try to send, CCB sends generally 8 people each year, and they try to do a mix of new people and old people. This year we had half and half, and that way the ones that have been there before can kind of mentor the newcomers. And I wanted Lucy to talk for a few minutes about what she felt as the experience as a newcomer, a first-timer to this event, and how helpful she felt it was to her to learn more about advocacy and actually be on the Hill.
Good afternoon, everyone. And Artis, I'd like to thank you for having me come up, because this gives me an opportunity to actually thank CCB in general for sending me to the legislative seminar. It was a lot more exciting than I thought it was going to be. Never having done anything like this before, I really wasn't sure what to expect in the process, procedures. And, I've been totally blind my entire life. I've never seen any pictures of Congress or any of things like this. Walking through those hallways was actually Very exciting. And looking for room numbers. I mean, the best way to describe the whole process was you would walk down a long, wide, cold hallway, and you would have your hand up on the wall, slightly above your head, looking for door numbers. And occasionally you'd turn a corner and, gee, there's Artis. Let's go into our next appointment together since you have an appointment now and I have a half hour. Which, to me, was really the best feeling about it all, is that we were all supporting each other. We were all working on the same thing. The group was a really nice group of people. I got to meet people from Southern California that I'd never, I mean, frankly, I'd maybe heard the name Lillian Scafie before, but never met her in person, never talked to her. We got to all sit down, talk about the issues, discuss it, help each other remember what we were supposed to be saying, and work together as a group, which was wonderful. And that, to me, is what CCB is all about. We all work together. We all have the same cause, the same, you know, we would sit there and, you know, we'd say something like, well, Randall Shepard doesn't mean anything to me necessarily because I'm not going into that program. But now that I've been told about what this program does and what this program is, I understand what the necessity, how it might affect. So on behalf of that, have the grant protected. And really, that was the most exciting thing about the whole process, was being able to not only talk about things that, you know, were important to me, like the descriptive video, Social Security, but things that were important to other blind people and make it so that they could actually, you know, become productive individuals and work in this world. And because of it, I think I've become a stronger advocate. And thank you once again for letting me attend the seminar.
Thank you, Lucy. One of the things I wanted to mention, too, is the nice thing about going as a group is we were able to meet together before we went on the Hill, and we each told about personal experiences that made different bills important to us as individuals. So even though we weren't able to go as a group to everyone, I mean, we did for the senators, of course, but we for the House members, we just had one or two go to each one. So consequently, we could take the other members in our group, their stories with us. I know Stephanie told us a story about rehab and how much it had been done for her and how important that program was. And I think that was really a good way for us to know other people's stories and share those. Because as we talk to representatives and senators, whether we go to Washington or go stay here in the state and talk to them here, our stories are the most important thing that pushes things along. If we tell our stories as we know them or talk about our friends that we know, that's what's going to help pass this federal legislation. And one quick note, I don't know how many have been keeping up, but SSI funding is right now in peril. So if you haven't contacted your representative and senator about that, please do so. Now, give it back to Jeff.
Okay. Thank you very much, Art Wolf-Artis and Lucy. And all of the participants, they did a fine job. They worked very hard to study the issues and to present our point of view in Washington, D.C. And I just encourage all of you to try and get that particular legislative seminar experience, because it is a unique one, and I don't think you'll ever quite be the same after you've done it. Okay. It's always a pleasure to be able to have someone return to us, and today we have Anthony Donaldson, who is a project manager from Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser is the largest health maintenance organization in the state. We have had ongoing dialogue with Anthony and Kaiser for a number of years. And without further ado, because I know how important healthcare access, ADA, and other issues are to all of you, I am going to bring back Anthony Donaldson.
Thank you very much. It's really great to return and share a lot of the great things that are happening at Kaiser Permanente today with you.
Just for a little background on Kaiser Permanente, nationally we're an organization that employs over 140,000 full-time employees and about 12,000 physicians are part of that group. We serve about 8.2 million members throughout the nation. Specifically, the way we're set up in California, we have two regions, Northern California and Southern California. And we have about 29 medical centers and well over 150 medical office buildings that are serving our members here in California. So the work that we're doing with our health access program here in California is pretty extensive and covers the majority of the organization. So what I'm here today to do is to talk to you a little bit about the California ADA Health Access Program and share a little bit about the way that we're structured and the work that we're doing and some of the successes that we've had over a couple of years since I've last spoke with you and providing some additional access solutions for our members with disabilities. The ADA program has been kind of focused on trying to review and improve access for all our members since 2001. I got involved with the organization around 2003, or with this group around 2003. In the dialogue that led to us forming our group, we decided to focus on two major issues, one being communication, not only communication within our organization about how we can better serve our members, but also communication with our members. And then we looked at different access points. And there are five key elements of our access points that I'm going to go over with you today. We looked at our architectural access. We looked at our medical equipment and how easy it is to access for a number of our members. We also looked, again, at communication as part of that. We looked at specific communication solutions. We re-reviewed and wrote new policies and procedures, and we're also focusing on training and education. So to give you a little bit more background on those areas and some of the successes that we've had over the last couple of years, I'll take those individually. Our architectural access piece, we actually hired an external consultant to come in and survey our sites to help us identify the barriers that are on those sites. Once we get those findings are going to a removal plan. And then also those findings are also rolled into what we call our templates, which is what we base building our new construction or upcoming hospital medical centers on, so that we are aware of those barriers and we don't repeat any concerns that were pointed out to us. The scope of the survey looks at everything from the site access points, so any bus drop-offs or stops or drops-offs, surfaces and different things around the parking area, the entrances, all the different service areas, whether it be cafeterias, lobby, waiting areas, cashier areas, the pharmacies, things of that nature. Really focus on the path of travel through our corridors and stairwells and the use of our elevators, public restrooms, of course, and then we get into specifics around the exam rooms for the medical office buildings or clinic areas and the patient rooms in our hospitals. So what we've typically been finding for a medical center is probably about 2,000 things that we can clean up or do better at each of the locations. And so we kind of group those into a phased process where over the next couple years we try to remediate those efforts. Our pilot sites that we did, they began in 2002. San Francisco was one site and Riverside was another. They're just to the point where they're beginning to complete their survey and remediation process for their existing locations. And we also have a plan right now that's working on all the additional locations in California. The surveys that are being done for each of those sites should be completed this year by year end, and then all the remediation at those medical centers will be completed by the end of 2008. It's basically taking about 2 to 3 years for them to complete the remediation process at the medical centers. The next program is our accessible medical equipment, and what we look at there is specifically the ability of the member to access medical equipment like an exam table or a scale or a procedure table. And what we've done is we've targeted our exam tables and our wheelchair scales, and in iServices we've come up with some chair glides to make them more accessible. There's a lot of mobility issues around in that, but also what I want to share with you about this equipment, which makes it really nice for all our members, is the new high-low exam tables that we've been able to incorporate into some of the clinics. It goes down to a height of 18 inches in its low position. Oh, got some applause there. Great. So not only is that, you know, help us with, you know, people of varying heights and mobility, but also it alleviates from people from having to step up on the old stools and things that, or little steps that were in the clinic areas to help you access those tables. So we're really happy that we can eliminate what we call or consider a trip or safety hazard in that regard. The other thing is our scales in general. We're trying to increase the size of the platform or our scales and also provide handrails. So a number of the scales that are in facilities were about 10 inches wide and 12 inches deep, a pretty small platform for anybody. But now we're going to scales that are more of a 20 by 20 or 20 or 40 by 40 platform even, in the case of our wheelchair scales, which everyone can access. And again, it helps us with the balance and trip issues that we tend to see with some of the other equipment that we're using. Another area where we're trying to make improvements, or we are making improvements, is our communication access solutions. In this area, what we like to look at is how we communicate with our members and provide different materials, including health information and medical information. Three areas that program we look at, the accessible media. In that particular area, what we do is we've made our Kaiser Permanente web page more accessible. So it now has been modified so that those of you that are using a screen reader software or screen enlargement software, it's very user-friendly in that regard now. another area is our assistive technology area. And right now in that area, we've been focused on getting assistive listening devices out there, so I don't know if any of you are hard of hearing, but we do have devices that will help in that regard. Another area is trying to provide materials in alternative formats. And we really have been working very hard on this, and it's still a huge work in progress for us, but I'd like to let you know some really great things that are happening with that. Right now, in our pharmacies areas, the labels on the prescription bottles and the prescription instructions are currently available in large print. Also, another thing that they're able to do, they're able to take that and convert it to an audio format in a case that they are providing that information on an audio CD for members. What? I'm getting there. Okay. I'm getting there. Okay. In addition, I realize that those are point services and so we're really looking at how we can improve on providing additional formats for that. So that in itself is a work in progress. But for those of you that are Kaiser Permanente members, and we are providing more and more information in large print in the audio format, and we also are focusing on Braille. Right now, those of you who are looking for KP publications, and what I mean by KP publications, these are documents that we print out regionally. That would be your membership information. That would be health information through guides like the HealthWise Handbook. If you contact the member services operator and give them your request and the different formats that work for you, they will contact our publications group as well as our office, and then we will make arrangements to work with the vendors to have that information sent to you in the format that you're looking for. So that is currently in place, and again, you want to contact your member services operator, and they will help you with that particular request. Now, when you're on site at the facilities and you're getting information from the physicians, you're getting updates here and there, there's a little bit more of a challenge for us. In those areas, we do have we're trying to test and work with some software. Again, it provides us the opportunity to take our documents either in a text or electronic format and convert them to an audio CD. For those of you that also are able to work with documents in electronic format, more and more of our staff members understand that they can email information to you or download information for you on disk and provide that to you so you can look at that in your leisure in your own homes. Again, so letting people know of the different formats that are available that you can work with is really important because we're educating our folks to work within in a variety of different ways. Additionally, for those of you that are Kaiser Permanente members, there's a quarterly newsletter that's available. It used to be called, I'm so used to the new name now. It's called Partners in Health now. And that's a quarterly letter that comes out for, depending on, it's service area specific, that talks about health issues. That is available on IDOCD. It can be sent to you at your home. The contact number for the Partners in Health group is 1-800-464-4000. That's 1-800-464-4000, and they will make sure that you receive that quarterly newsletter in that alternate format, which is the audio CD. Another thing that we're doing, and the project is going through a couple phases, but right now we're working with the medical center locations. We are installing computers in the health education department that have scan and read software, text enlargement software, and also the ability to create documents on the audio CD. So if you have information, if you need information, you can go to health education. The staff there, again, assist you in scanning in documents and helping you get that successful. Same thing, we see how it's in the clinics and some of the inpatients. Again, that would be for staff use with doctor discharge situations. The next area, policies and procedures. We adopt 6 statewide policies, a policy on service animals, a policy on effectively WAMBR, the use of our high-low tables and some of the specialized accessible rooms that we put together. Again, providing materials in an alternative format and the use of auxiliary aids. These policies are in review right now by all of our medical centers. They're being revised and adopted to their local formats. And we hope to have all these policies in place by year end of 2005. The next area is training and education. And this is an area we hope to really expand on in 2006. But currently, what we're able to do is internally, our department, Sherry Samuels and myself, makes up our California ADA compliance team. We put together an intranet website that all of our staff can access that has all the information about our projects as well as a number of accommodation solutions for all of our members with disabilities. We've also put together a manager's resource guide, which thank you for your input from a number of you, which is to help them train their staff how to better accommodate our members with disabilities. We also are doing, for instance, how we can better accommodate our members with disabilities. We actually have a conference coming up this November that's focusing on the use of alternative formats and providing the use of alternative formats and auxiliary aids. So our nurses will get some training on being able to assist you. Our physicians are getting training. We don't have a physician-specific training yet, but we are working on that. But we have developed a provider handbook and pocket guide for them with tips on how to better assist and service, and they've already been given that information. Some additional tools that we're trying to work on, we're trying to work on some online training for the staff, together short videos to help, and from a customer standpoint, help people really understand how to better accommodate all our members, including our members with disabilities. In closing, I hope that what I've shared with you today is good news, and I'm excited about being involved in implementing all these projects throughout the state. It's been a joy working with all of you and other members that have given me a lot of insight on ways that we can improve services, and I'm really happy to be here to share this with you today.
Thank you. I know we're going to run a little behind, but I really want to have time for maybe 3 questions because I know there will be interest out there. Well, we'll take the first 3 that get to a mic, I guess.
Okay. Anthony, this is Gene Lozano. My question is, what is the status of that project in San Diego for the talking prescription bottles?
Okay. I'm not directly with that. That's a farm and share with you, based on what I've heard. They ran on the manufacturer's ability to provide the little device in various, and obviously locations, so they're concerned around being able to accommodate all the different size prescription bottles that are distributed. And again, I know that some of the pharmacists were also concerned about the way that the application was applied to the bottle and was concerned that maybe things might get switched. So I know that they're still discussing it. It's still in discussion. I don't think it's a closed issue. But they're hoping that they can work with the manufacturer to accommodate some of our concerns from a safety standpoint to make sure that those modifications are available so we can make something like that available to members.
Okay, next question.
This is Frank Welty. I've been a Kaiser member on and off for about 16 years now, and I have yet to receive any materials in accessible format. And I'm concerned about what you're saying in terms of it sounds like you're busy doing a lot of cool things. However, it sounds to me like a lot of it is sort of being rolled out. And given the size of your organization, I'm concerned about the time frames we're talking about for rolling them out and actually getting them up to speed. The second thing I'm concerned about is that it sounds like a lot of the accessibility services you plan to be offering are going to be offered on an at-request basis. And I'm just wondering, on any given request, how many weeks can we expect to receive a response?
Okay. I think I had a couple questions in there. Help me stay focused here. You're right. The computer access things that we're putting in place are being deployed now, and they'll be deployed through August. So the health information, the health education area and things like that, those things are being upgraded now as part of our system. The materials from the KP materials that are available to you are available now. You can contact your member services operator, and they will contact our office, and we'll have those sent to a vendor and then sent to you. As far as turnaround time on that, I've seen anywhere from a couple weeks to about a month just because of all the people working together. So, again, this will be your membership materials and your health education materials that are provided. And hopefully we can get a little quicker. Now, the request that you might be making locally, a health class, that's what we're going to work with you directly. So, for instance, if you're about to attend a diabetes care, being aware of your need, those are class in another format, and you can come to class and enjoy the class members. Very diligently on that right now. Another question, make sure I got it. The needs. We have a huge program developed right now. They're spending quite a bit of dollars on it. Make sure that it has a lot of great information in terms of their needs and the needs of members with disabilities so that we, prior to any clinic visit or any patient visit, ask whether it be any mobile things of that nature, so plan for your visits in the future. And that system's worked in right now, starting to be rolled out across the
system. Just that, I mean, your answer to that last question, to think of one and comment. I noticed that... I mean, it doesn't even say anywhere on our charts that we're blind, and I don't know why something can't be put on there that says blind needs accessible format. Seems like that would solve the problem rather simply. I've just been through your system and had gastric bypass surgery, and on the whole, Kaiser Fremont did a commendable job once I went through the experience of talking to the surgeon and practically having a fight with him at my orientation, and he sent me all of the information I needed to her computer and sent it to mine, and that worked out very well. And all the staff, but, you know, does it have to be so damn now? The electronics and the ease with which I had hemoglobin A1C of 10, and that's really high for a diabetic. And I wanted to know what to do, and the reference information the ADA that she admitted was my folks doing for me as a healthcare provider.
Again, Andrew, thanks for the information that you access. We now have steps in place to where we can help you access that information quicker and more updated information by the dietitian identifying that need locally can work with their ADA coordinator at the site. We do have ADA coordinators at each location, each medical center, and that material can be converted to a more accessible format for you. So that is in place now at all the medical centers. It's just a matter of communication and education, which we're really focusing on trying to get the word out right now, serve you.
Yeah, come the January.
Yeah, and we're...
So it can't have been in place long
enough. I'm sorry. A lot of this is really, we've been working very hard on purchase, focus on the staff edge. You're a bit of the game, but more at the, all your care sounded good, but the little things that were a ding for you alleviate in the future.
Well, the little I needed, they weren't fair that I needed in a format that I could access with relatively good health.
Point taken.
We ask you to give us both your phone number and emails.
Absolutely. I can be reached at area code 510-986-33. Again, it's 510-987-4533. It's Anthony, A-N-T-H-O-N-Y, dot Donaldson, O-N, at E, dot O-R-G.
I want to thank Anthony very much for
having me here.
Okay. We are a little behind, but just for you, Dominic, we'll do one. In just a moment, we'll do one. Pat Burns, are you in the room? You won.
Raise your hand if you're here, please.
What did she win?
$25 and a T-shirt from ACB Capital Chapter. No, you're not here? Well, apparently we were misinformed. So we'll draw again. Mary Beth Randall, are you here? Mary Beth. Uh-oh. Okay, we got another one. Taking longer than sometimes. Katrina McCurdy, are you here? Yes, no? She's here, okay. First timer from the Redwood Empire chapter. So, all right. Okay, affordable housing is a very important issue that we in the council have dealt with levels, anything. On the state level in terms of our convention. It's something that I was extremely concerned about and Jean Lazar. And today we want to present to you a panel on what the county has done in this area and the alliance, Ethan Evans.
Thank you. We're just making our way here. And I'm joined today by Sacramento County staff, or one of our Sac County staff, person from our redevelopment agency who I'll in and just... And I want to thank the council for inviting us here today, and also Jean Lozano, who is a local leader in Sacramento, who asked us to come. So thank you, Jean. And let's see here. How many people traveled to Sacramento for the meeting this weekend? Wow. Who thinks they're the farthest person? Anybody? Any San Diego? All right. Well, welcome here. Welcome to Sacramento. And how many people have seen that rents and housing costs are going up in their area?
Yeah. Most everybody.
Okay, so you're new to Sacramento, but not new to what we're going to be talking about a little bit today. We're going to talk about a couple things. We're going to talk about a new ordinance that was passed here in Sacramento. We'll talk about some of the specifics of what that ordinance does and how that happened. And so just as a way of introduction, our panelists today are myself, Ethan Evans. I'm the director of an organization that is made up of member organizations. We do community outreach about the need for affordable housing, talking to community groups. We also provide technical assistance around fair housing issues like reasonable accommodation laws, and we've had workshops with different property managers. And then there's Cindy Cavanaugh here from the Sacramento Redevelopment Agency. She's a management analyst who's worked with SHRA, which is the acronym for our redevelopment agency, for 6 years. She also worked for the State Department of Housing and brings a huge amount of experience to her job in the work that, and working with Sacramento Tenants Association here. And Leanne Moffitt, who's a planner with the County of Sacramento for 17 or 18. We passed an ordinance program that's called inclusionary zoning. And inclusionary zoning is one tool that's used to make sure that when new housing is built, a percentage of that housing is made affordable. And in your areas, some places may have a similar requirement. San Diego was working on a requirement. There's about 107 different cities and counties in California that require, when you build new housing, a percentage of that housing is made affordable. And there's a number of things that we want to just throw out as considerations in thinking about this. Inclusionary housing works well when is building, because if it isn't, it's not a tool that really provides of new housing units. How many people? Well, excuse me with that question. And so ordinances are for different areas. So I'm going to talk just quickly. When we talk about affordable, it's pretty amazing that covers a large range of what is affordable, from families are making $51,000 a year down to families, which we talked about, making $20,000 a year and less. And most of the housing, and we'll talk about why that's important in a minute. And at this point, I'd like to go with a program in the county.
Thanks for that, Ethan. So I'm going to talk about this ordinance that the county adopted in December of last year, so it's in effect closer. Sort of the background that led to Consolidated County. Every jurisdiction required this element. And on our last housing element, Sacramento County had been sued by Legal Services of Northern California. And we had entered into a settlement agreement that said we had to maintain a certain amount of vacant land. And over time, we had fallen out of compliance with that settlement agreement. We didn't have the amount of vacant land that we were supposed to have. It was for a variety of reasons. People constructed projects on the vacant land. We had some incorporations in Sacramento County. We have a somewhat unusual circumstance here where the unincorporated county is very urban. It's not rural. And there have been some new cities that have been created. So that caused some sort of technical problems for us when it came to creating our new housing element, which we were required to do and we were facing doing. These sort of technical issues. We also had substantially increasing money, like most of California. Housing prices have gone, so to speak, in the last several years. And it was becoming more and more difficult for folks to be able to afford housing. So that sort of set the stage for the discussion on this updated housing element and sort of the political background that was going on as we prepared it and considering it. So a couple-year process went along, and it was very controversial. There was hearing after hearing before the board. The local housing advocates were very organized and were coming and filling the board chambers during the hearings, and they were really advocating for a much more aggressive policy than was initially being considered. Initially on the table was a program that would require 10% of all new development be it affordable to low and very low income. And the housing advocates came into the process, and they were really advocating for a 15% program, and they wanted targeting at extremely low income levels, which is not an income level that most inclusionary ordinances address. So this ordinance was prepared, long, awful meetings, and that was finally drafted, targeted 15% requirements. 6% at low income, at very low, and 3% extremely low. There were a couple of provisions in here that had to do with accessibility, and Cindy Kavanaugh hit upon that because I think it's going to interest you. But really, extremely low income level, what would the target be? How much cost? Could we practically do it? And in order to do it, we prioritized land dedication. In most inclusionary ordinances, the developer of a project, say some developers coming in with a 500-unit project, and they have to either construct themselves or find a low-income developer to construct, 15% of the units. In this case, because we wanted to target extremely low income, we came up with a strategy and a program that would have land dedicated to the county, an SHRA, and that land that was dedicated to us is where the extremely low-income units would be constructed, so that the public agency would take the obligation for that deep income targeting rather than the developer. And so that's sort of the strategy that got this developed and what's unique about this ordinance. There are a lot of details to the ordinance. One of the unique provisions is that it has a whole lot of options. And I don't want to bore you. I mean, Cindy and I can sit down and we'll spend up to an hour with a developer talking about what all our options are. So that's probably a little more detail than you want to hear today. We would be happy to talk your ear off some other time if you want to hear about all the myriad of options. There are some, I'll just try to describe it in very general overterms. There are some options for some folks to pay fees. And there are options for larger developers have to dedicate land, and certain other folks will have to either construct the units. They can construct them on site. They can construct them off site. They can partner with other developers. In some cases, they can construct for sale units at just low income. In some instances, they can do a rental product at low and very low. So there are a whole variation of options in this ordinance. And it takes quite a long flow chart when we sit down with a developer with their project to go through and figure out what all those options are. There are also some density bonus incentives, fairly common type incentives. One that's somewhat unique is that if a developer is coming forward and they don't require a rezone and we require them in this ordinance to construct an apartment project, they're allowed to do that under this ordinance without having to go through a rezoning project, which can be a very politically challenging process for them to do. So we now have this ordinance adopted. It's going fairly well. In the county, as Ethan mentioned, one of the things that is making this ordinance work is the fact that Sacramento County has a lot of growth areas. We have just in pending projects before the planning department right now, we have over 24,000 units worth of projects in pending applications. So that is one of the things that is making this work, and folks are picking a lot of these different options. We have been sued by the building industry on this ordinance, so there's still a certain amount of political issues. And they had some concerns about the ordinance. Initially, they wanted to simply dedicate the land for that to be their obligation, and there were several other detailed provisions of the ordinance that they ended up not being too happy about. So we'll see how that comes out. And now I'm going to turn things back over to Ethan, who's going to talk about some of the background to the need for housing.
Thank you. And so a little bit in Sacramento, again, there Leanne mentioned that there were groups that came together to really advocate for this program, but that came out of a lot of pre-work. First of all, we were looking at what affordable was and what that meant in Sacramento, in our community, and what rents were doing. Been involved in advocating for. Okay, good. So, and like that many, it was probably about 6, 7, 8. That's good to hear. Well, what have we produced in the county? Because that we have a good amount of homes being built, about 4 homes built prior to years before this program, and about 4 or 5% of the affordable was close to what the need in our community. A lot of people who earn less than $1,000 a year, and person two is 760 to 808 a month. We had a rental survey that not only were rents going up, but that at the lower end, the vacant, so it was really hard to get into an apartment, and landlords were able to have pretty strict requirements about credit, about the income you have to earn to move into a place. I'm sure these aren't new ideas. This is more the case in many communities. And another thing is that we were looking at the fact that as we're building new communities, they weren't integrated with the diversity of incomes that that residents have. So seniors weren't typically able to move into – seniors on a fixed income weren't able to move into new homes being built. Workers in those areas weren't finding the housing using these new schools or for the benefits of new neighborhoods. And so it was this housing element process where there's really a window to get involved. And so I encourage each person here involved with groups or individually to talk to their local officials about when is their housing element due. And it's a real simple question because every jurisdiction, every city or county has to update this every 5 years. And so or they update it every year, but they have to do a whole new one and get it approved every 7. So it's the avenue where that's about a housing, and it's a place where you can talk about what are we doing to build. And also link, because if a jurisdiction or city doesn't pass a housing element, then they can be sued by anybody. And in this case, there was legal services in Northern California that had got involved. So community groups could link under that pressure from the legal community to be involved. And again, this is a 2-year process. There were early meetings with developers, which really made this process something different than what had happened before. The last time we were talking about affordable housing in this way in Sacramento County, developers and builders were not involved and were extremely opposed to the idea. And 10 years later, we were able to talk with, and we went into a, and that changed the dynamic of how this process was going to happen. So we went into some workshops. The housing element provides a whole lot of data on what the housing situation is. So we had a lot of data to work with. There was a stakeholders process that took about 3 months, 4 months?
2 years.
There was a concentrated, that's right, there was a concentrated stakeholders process that went on for quite some time.
It stopped and started.
That's right. We do have anecdotal stories about one of the people in our coalition had her child was pregnant when much of this started, and then two when while the time passed. There was a process and back and forth to the Board of Supervisors. Really, what made the difference? I mean, what the things that helped from our strategy points? There was a lot of turning points and a lot of important points that the developers being around in the process was important. But one of the things that was important for us was that the groups involved got together very early, and we came up with principles that we were going to hold up for this whole process. And we stuck to them for the most part. And we talked about this 15%, talked about including extremely low income, having measures for accessibility, because often we talk about affordable and the policies for accessibility didn't link, and this program does that to some degree. And really at the heart of the issue was the extremely low income. And the predominant key that I'd like to sort of leave with the group today about how this came about was really a matter of persistence and being involved in every meeting and showing up repeatedly to talk about the need for affordable housing. And there was a point near the end, it seemed developers may have moved away from being involved. They weren't as vocal. It was just weird, and it almost like too late. Like there was a point where it had to happen, and so it's important. And some elders' involvement seemed to cool off, and diligence of several programs with a report and were ready to. And also, we had two new supervisors being elected, and there was a lot of agreement that nobody wanted to recontinue this with new members of the Board of Supervisors. So there's a real push to get something passed. And so those things really serve to make this process come together. So I'll turn it over to Cindy Cavanaugh.
Thank you and good afternoon. I'm going to speak briefly about some of the principles that you've heard that we went through and we just kind of in a group process over 2 years emerged that helped us craft our ordinance. And I'm going to raise these in that you would think of them if you approach doing a similar type ordinance. One of them is inclusion. It's important. It was very important to the housing that was affordable was included in the development. Because of the way the ordinance offers a lot of options, you have to ask, how far out can the affordable housing be? Within the development, within the neighborhood, within the community planning area. And we have that incorporated. The very deep affordability really affected our choice, how we could approach the ordinance about to subsidize that those low income. And we felt we were probably going to be meeting low income through rental. So you have to ask what kind of do you want rental and ownership? We did want both. That's another kind of key question you have to ask. Ethan mentioned the partnership. I don't think this could have happened if we did not engage the developers and the advocates as well as the county and our agency's staff. We tried to build on the strengths of each of those partners. Actually, it was a developer that first proposed the land dedication model, and the advocates didn't really like it for some good reasons, but it made sense in the strength of each partner, developer and deliver a structure. They had to build affordable housing. The affordable developer, who was also a stakeholder, knows how to get affordable financing. To build these units, you really need to be strategic and get competitive financing, whether it's the 9% credits or some of the state programs. They're good at that, but they couldn't get the land. They were not even in the running for the land because of the market we have in Sacramento. And then the local government partners were there and were expected to contribute also. You can't do this without some local contribution of funds. And the county has a lot to offer in terms of increased density. So that was the partnership we tried to keep alive to make this ordinance work to some degree for everybody. Leanne mentioned we have a lot of options. And the reason for that is you have to ask, who's this going to apply to? Our county to every single man over 4 units new growth areas. It's the large and small. It's the under four that for those corporate builds as well as those small home builders. It's for multifamily. We wanted both rental, which is that. See is important. What we wanted to see is that the housing, the four, at that point you have a built opposition to affordable development. And if your kitty is like ours, opposition whether a project can be built or not prior to concrete development in that in our ordinance. And then finally, accessibility, more detail about that principle. For, I'm not sure why or how, and you know, appreciate my ignorance on this, why or how accessibility really fit in with an inclusionary ordinance. I thought it was sort of apples and oranges. The housing element speaks about visitability and universal design and certain goals, but I thought by adding this on we were making it too complicated, and I hope Warren is at least chuckling on that. Because it ended up being, I think, a very effective way to get the board, our Board of Supervisors to look at accessible housing when you're doing affordable housing accessible. And so there was agreement, there was a fair amount of agreement this would be an important principle. And there was also a fair amount of that to occur. Maybe the affordable developers understood the requirements of the federal and the state in terms of making units accessible or how what was required for multifamily or what were the state requirements, but a lot of the policymakers did not understand, and so there was a fair amount of education that was important. What the ordinance ended up saying was that of the affordable housing that is developed, we're going to apply Section 504, which is a federal requirement that typically goes along when there's federal funding, but we're going to apply it whether there's federal funding or not. The reason that was sellable was, I think, because a lot of the affordable units will have federal, and we kind of understand that world. The affordable developers understand it. We were going to apply it just to the multifamily affordable. And those requirements basically are that 5% would be accessible to persons with mobility impairments, and an additional 2% would be for accessible for those with hearing and vision impairments. And we would also apply the uniform federal accessibility standards, so there would be some uniformity. We still have to do more education as we implement the ordinance, but I think with that, we're probably open to questions. We're open to questions. Thank you.
Okay, I want to before we go on, we have one more important short item, but because we don't have time for questions, I would like to ask our panelists, because this is such an important item, if they're able to stay up front for maybe 10 or 15 minutes afterwards, and upon adjournment, which will be very soon, people could come to the front. Will that work for our panelists?
Sure.
And address questions to you? That would be great, because this is an issue which I am happy we have done it at this convention and in housing and future conventions, because there's a lot of other for our panelists. Thank you, and all of you. Last, you know, this convention would not go anywhere near as smoothly as it does without all of our wonderful sort of permanent volunteers, such as Rex and Mary Lou and Pinky. And I learned a day late, but I guess it's going to be close enough, that Pinky Carell had a birthday yesterday. So it is time to sing for Pinky. I don't want to lead. Somebody lead this. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Pinky. Happy birthday to you. All right. And I hear she's 27. Okay. We adjourn till PM. That's up to you.